Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, I'm Dr. Robert Pearl, former CEO of the Permanente Medical Group, Kaiser Permanente, a Stanford Medical and Business School professor, a Forbes contributor and best-selling author of the book Mistreated, Why We Think We're Getting Good Healthcare and Why We're Usually Wrong.
And I am Jeremy Corr, host of the New Books in Medicine podcast. American healthcare is broken. Across the United States, there are over 200,000 patient deaths from medical error every year, growing physician burnout, outdated technology, and inconvenient and delayed care for patients. And on top of all of this, skyrocketing drug prices and increasingly unaffordable out-of-pocket patient expenses. For decades, our nation's political and medical leaders have talked about fixing the American healthcare system, and yet the problems are now greater than in the past.
Every other industry that is inefficient and ineffective has experienced disruption. Healthcare will be no different. The question is whether the solutions will come from inside the healthcare system or be imposed on it. We'd like to invite you to listen to our new podcast, Fixing Healthcare with Dr. Robert Pearl and Jeremy Corr. Each episode will feature one of the top leaders and innovative thinkers in healthcare today. The show's format is simple. The guests will present a roadmap for fixing American healthcare's biggest problems. And from there, Jeremy and I will scrutinize the plan and help listeners separate fixes that have the potential to succeed from simply the hype.
Our goal is that everyone from healthcare consumers to political and medical leaders will find value in the discussions on our show. You may not agree with the different solutions offered, but you will never again conclude that nothing can be done. We hope you will join us. Please subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcast software. For more information, visit our website at www.fixinghealthcarepodcast.com.
Welcome to New Books Network. I'm your host, Monique Dufour. Today we have a somewhat different kind of interview happening today. We're talking with the editors and contributors to the website Somatosphere. Somatosphere describes itself as a collaborative website covering the intersections of medical anthropology, science and technology studies, cultural psychiatry, psychology, and bioethics. You can find them online at somatosphere.net. I have three guests today. The first is Eugene Reichel. He's the editor of Somatosphere, and he's also an assistant professor in the Department of Comparative Human Development at the University of Chicago. Second, we have Todd Myers. He's the associate editor at Somatosphere, and he is assistant professor of medical anthropology at Wayne State University. Listeners may remember Todd from a previous interview on New Books in Medicine about his wonderful book, The Clinic and Elsewhere, Addiction, Adolescence, and the Afterlife of Therapy. Finally, we have Emily Yates Dorr. She's a member of the Editorial Collaborative and Assistant Professor of Anthropology at the Amsterdam Institute for Social Science Research. So we're talking about a website on the New Books Network today. It's not a book, but it does exemplify how websites are becoming significant places and formats for scholarly discourse and exchange. In many ways, they too have become bookish insofar as they express long thoughts, they rely on expertise, they engage in collective conversations within scholarly communities, and they provoke our thought. In our conversation today, We're going to talk about the subject matter of Somatosphere, how it addresses topics in science, medicine, and anthropology. And I also aim for us to explore how these digital environments are transforming how we do scholarly work, including how we conceive of it, how we create it, how we circulate it, and what it means. Welcome to the New Books Network, to my guests. Hello.
Hi.
So Somatosphere is a very successful example of scholarly engagement on a digital platform. And I wanted to start with you, Eugene, and I'm wondering if you might take us back to the early days of the project. I understand that it began in 2008.
Sure.
What was the status of digital scholarship at the time, and why did you dive in?
Well, I mean, I think there were a number of kinds of platforms where anthropologists were regularly going to and having conversations and doing a kind of work that seemed to be somewhat akin to what has been called the corridor talk, right? Other kinds of conversations that are not necessarily as formal as the ones that take place in academic journals and other public venues of publication, but were somewhat more kind of worked out and more formal than everyday kinds of conversations with colleagues. So Savage Minds was one that had been online for several years. I think that when we started Neuroanthropology, a site run by Dan Lendy and Greg Downey, had been up for maybe it started the same year that we started. And one of the things that, initially attracted me to the idea of starting a site was just the fact that there wasn't anything for medical anthropology of this kind at the time. It wasn't really a matter of, any much more highly developed ideas than that. Uh-huh. One of the ideas that was there from the very beginning was the notion that this should be a place for a kind of an interdisciplinary forum, right? Or something where that would center on medical anthropology, but would connect it with other kinds of other disciplines, other methodological approaches, which came to meet around questions of knowledge production, science, biomedicine, treatment, healing, these kinds of issues. So that was really it. I can speak a little bit more about how it took form. So basically, around July 2008, I contacted a small group of colleagues, Todd, a few others, Matt Wolfmeyer, who's at University of California, Santa Cruz, Aaron Koch, who's now at University of Kentucky, Ann Kelly, who's at University of Exeter now, Stephanie Lloyd, who's at Laval, and maybe a couple of others, and just proposed the idea of starting a web blog on anthropology, medical anthropology. And what became very clear early on was that as soon as you start one of these sites, there's an immediate pressure to continue kind of putting up new material, right? It's been discussed elsewhere that the kind of life, the shelf life of any of these online kind of materials is quite short, at least insofar as people expect something after a certain fairly short time frame, right? Mm-hmm. So you have to walk this kind of maintain a balance between producing something that will keep people coming back relatively quickly, and then on the other hand, what I really wanted to avoid was allowing it to become just kind of content, in the sort of commodified sense of we'll just put anything up there just to keep people coming in. So the first year and a half, really, I spent a lot of time doing the kind of work that sometimes gets a little elevated by calling it curation. Uh-huh. I'm a little ambivalent about that term, but a lot of pointing people in the direction of other things that were going on online, a lot of kind of posting of small things. And then also, at the same time, I think it became clear to me that at least I wasn't the sort of person who was able to, write quickly off the cuff kinds of contributions of the sort that the folks at Savage Minds, for example, have been really, really successful at. And that what would be needed was a little bit more kind of editorial structure. And so what we started to do was to invite contributions in certain genres. So we started doing book reviews quite early on. We started doing posts putting together recent articles in these areas. And then about 6 months later, we did another call for contributors. Kalman Applebaum, University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, joined, and Sadek Rahimi, who is now at University of Saskatchewan. And both of them came on board to do a series of posts around particular topics that they were working on and thinking about. So again, this was another way to address this issue of sort of how do you structure things within this platform that really we don't know what to, we can do, anything with it, really. Mm-hmm. Todd, do you want to jump in at all here?
Yeah, of course. Well, I guess to the first part of Monique's question, thank you. Yes, we about the site being a success. I mean, my God. I think this is part of the existential anxiety of a website like this, even from the very beginning. One of the things that we tried to do when it first started was to sort of create a resource, call for papers, conference announcements. And then when it evolved into this other form where these sort of short series or short essays or mm-hmm. essays in process were being posted on the site, as well as these book reviews that were coming out very close to the publication date of the books. And that's one of the things we tried to do early on, is kind of utilize this medium, because we were able to, first of all, convince graduate students that this was a great place to write book reviews for the first time, mm-hmm. And they would turn them around. But it was also, we really had the advantage of being able to be the first kind of review of a particular text. And we were finding, to our surprise, that publishers were not only happy with this, but they were, taking quotes from these reviews and posting mm-hmm. on, the book pages on their websites. So it was sort of a nice way to reinforce kind of what we were doing, because, a major problem with an effort like this is developing some kind of trust early on. When you take time out of your sort of scholarly life to, sit down and write a review, or to, to type out an essay or a few thoughts that, maybe are not, fully formulated, or, really, really kind of, provisional, you have to sort of trust that these things don't go into a void, or they go into a form where they're just going to be, taken and misused in some way. And so I think that was part of the effort very early on, is to kind of develop some trust and also work on follow through for these things, so we would have sort of fresh content all the time, and that we would, somehow be able to create a conversation that wasn't happening elsewhere, mm-hmm. and not just sort of reproducing the same form that we were seeing on other websites, whether they were blogs or kind of online journals or whatever, but also something that wasn't happening in the journals themselves, which was, at least for my part as the book reviews editor for the first 5 years of the site, it was turning those things around quickly in order to kind of alert readers of what was being published, but also, to sort of, begin to kind of shape a conversation about new scholarship as it becomes new, create that as a resource. So this is sort of, just to add a little bit of detail to what Eugene has already said, I think that was really part of the effort in the beginning.
Uh-huh. So, yeah, absolutely. And I think, go ahead.
Oh, no, please continue.
No, I was just going to just follow up on a couple of the things that Todd said. I think this idea of establishing trust and bringing with our readers and the contributors was really a central issue for the whole site, right? I mean, with these kinds of efforts, in some ways you have to convince people and really make clear that this is something that's going to stay around for a while, right? This is not an effort that's going to, this is not something that's going to disappear after a couple months, which, you know, we've seen plenty of efforts like that online, and it's totally, you know, that's not surprising. Mm-hmm. That where there's a lot of effort goes into it at the beginning, and then it doesn't necessarily hit its stride or continue. So just convincing people, making it clear that this is something that's here to stay, at least for some length of time, and that there's, you know, a kind of seriousness to it.
Well, and frankly,
really important. Yeah,
I'm still tickled and amazed every time people post things on the site. I'm like, wow, think this seriously, they're actually doing things. Yeah. Every post is a sort of a minor victory. And I know we're going to probably talk about some of the series and different things that's going on recently, but yeah, I mean, this has really been the case all the way up to sort of the present moment, where, you know, just the effort that other people make into shaping the site through these contributions is, to me, kind of astounding, because, you know, I know Eugene and I have talked a lot about this over the years, just even trying to understand the genre in which work is being produced on this website is kind of difficult to nail down. And for a lot of people, I mean, for people who are established and well-recognized scholars, I mean, it's wonderful that they contribute, and we're very happy and again, kind of amazed. But also, I think for scholars who are in the very early stages of their careers, you know, to take time and energy to do really truly creative and cutting edge work through the site, and to also have some kind of confidence that this counts for something beyond just the shelf life of the site or the particular post, that this contributes in a really robust way to the field or fields. You mentioned quite a bit of them in the beginning, but I think that's also part of it. It's like that, it's not just the trust that, you know, you better not take a screenshot of your post quickly just in case the site, you know, is down tomorrow. but rather like that this will have a lasting effect in one's own scholarship.
Yes.
That, you know, that this will make some kind of small little etch in, you know, in your sort of scholarly record in a good way. I think when people contribute in that way, it's really heartening. So
that's a fascinating way to put it. I'm wondering if this would be a good time to bring in Emily. Emily, you came in. How long have you been a part of Somatosphere?
Well, that's interesting because, of course, understanding what makes one a part of the journal is itself an interesting question.
That's great.
I can tell you. So I came to the journal for the first time when I was writing my dissertation. So this was back in 2009. And my research was looking, I was looking at how the diagnosis of obesity in Guatemala intersected with these other techniques of social standardization, like race and class and gender and citizenship. And I was having, you know, part of the PhD trajectory, you find an identity for yourself. Mm-hmm. And I was having a really hard time, maybe because I was studying attempts at classification and the failure of those attempts at classifying myself. It was really exciting for me when I came, when I first encountered Somatosphere, discovering this like fabulous online site, bringing together work of others who are similarly interested in working outside or at least alongside traditional academic divides. So they weren't just collaborating across conventional networks, but also taking up the question of what it meant and what it did to collaborate in experimental ways. And I've been a regular reader and contributor to Somatosphere. I've been reading it since 2009 and contributing shortly after that. Just as another note, because I walked into the PhD workroom and I asked earlier today, because I knew we were doing this, and I said, "You guys, tell me about Somatosphere. What do you like?" And the students looked up and they were, you know, they're just like, "Oh, in the journals, it saves me so much time." I can stay so up to date. And I think there's kind of a sense that there's, you know, the kind of production of scholarship is so, you know, there's so much that happens. And so here's this kind of, you know, other people doing the work of organizing, you know, of organizing it. They were all just like, "Oh, it's such a useful resource to have." Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And so what is your relationship with the project now?
Okay, so let's see. It was a couple years back. I think it was 2013. Thomas Matzett and Harris Solomons, they launched this amazing series called Common Places. Mm-hmm. And Common Places was set out to itemize the technological present. And regular Somatosphere readers can probably relate to looking forward to Mondays when the next item of the cabinet would be released. And it really was just a terrific series. And so as Common Places was going on, there was a business meeting at the AAA's where the chair of the meeting asked, you know, does anyone have ideas for a series to follow up Common Places? And so at the time, I had done earlier field work in a village, but I had moved out and was doing field work at the UN. And what happens at the UN is really no less dizzying than what happens anywhere else. But I no longer had the geopolitical boundaries of the nation state to rely on when explaining my field work to other anthropologists. And I was really grappling with how our field organizes its knowledge. So we live in these like incredibly complex, entangled worlds where we just can't map it out. And, you know, we're never going to map it all. So kind of entering this post-representational mode of anthropology, how do we undertake the disentangling that needs to happen for writing and storytelling to proceed? What tools do we have? What repertoires can we draw on when making our cases? And so kind of at this meeting, I like raised my hand and said, I have this idea, which is, let's talk about the ethnographic case. And from the very start, Christine Labuski, who's an anthropologist at Virginia Tech, she joined me in this project. And we've been gathering creative thinkers to work through and think through how case making in anthropology and in kind of ethnographic case making relates and departs from case making in other fields. So the medical case, the legal case, the detective case. Hopefully this isn't like too kind of lofty, but we're really trying to work through like the art and science of storytelling in some ways, kind of thinking about how our field uses like particular cases to make general knowledge or, you know, moves away from the desire to make general knowledge. We're halfway through the series. It's called The Ethnographic Case. It comes out on Mondays every other week. In the series, we've really tried to bring together the work of senior and junior scholars to draw kind of as diverse of a range of contributors into the conversation. And Eugene and Todd can add what they think about it if they want. But one of the things that's been really interesting for me is seeing virtually with every post that the case is made to be something different than what it was the case before. Uh-huh. And so we have this kind of very Baroque assemblage right now. It's coherence without replication. It's texture, not pattern. But I've learned a lot about, I've really learned about like the diversity that exists, not just in what we study as anthropologists, but also in how we study it.
Eugene or Todd, did you want to, do you have any reflections on the ethnographic case?
Well, I think just generally it's a great example of what I think can work the best on this kind of a site, in this kind of a platform. And that's to say that, someone comes up with an idea of something that they want to, is a concern to them at the moment, and that can be worked through in this kind of editorial curatorial mode of bringing other people together to think about it, and that doesn't necessarily fit very well within the platform of a traditional print journal. I mean, it could, but the also takes advantage really nicely of some of the opportunities offered by this medium. So there's this beautiful bookcase that was designed specifically for the series, and this follows up again on the series that Tomasa and Harris made, where there was a series of cubbies produced for the kind of a separate page to enter into this series of posts. Mm-hmm. And I think that very nicely uses to its advantage the particular what you can do online in this kind of a setting that you couldn't necessarily elsewhere.
Absolutely.
Todd?
I wanted to just jump in for a second and just elaborate on what you pointed out. So in the ethnographic case on the website and in the commonplaces series, it makes great use of visual rhetoric and design as well. Who's responsible for that design and how did that become integrated in your vision for how you would express and share the ideas through the digital medium?
Right. So we started out, this has to do with a shift that we made in 2011, where we hired Martin Audens, who's a web designer and also just a graphic designer, to redesign the whole site. So until that time, we had been running off of Blogger. It's a Blogger site, quite basic. And Martin redesigned the site on the WordPress platform and did really a beautiful job of not only making the site, I think, aesthetically engaging, but making a kind of a space that could be built upon, right? And that would not, first of all, look dated very quickly. I think it still looks quite, it doesn't look to me that dated 4 years later. But also that could be, again, built upon in these various ways. So Martin worked with Tomas and Harris to build this special page for commonplaces. And then for the ethnographic case, you had a different designer. I don't know if you want to talk about that process at all, Emily.
It was really important for us to not, I love Thomas and Harris's, I love the cabinet, but we wanted something different. So we went to a different designer and had them, we sort of talked about our ideas and kind of the importance of the particular, the importance of, you know, kind of texture and they came up with the design and then we roll it out every week. So the designer puts in a new case to our book, our expanding bookcase. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, like we had all these kind of lofty ambitions that we'd be incorporating, you know, video and all kinds of textual images. And in some ways, we're a little bit limited by our own technological capacities. But at least kind of the imagination for what we wanted it to be is there.
So these two things that we've just been talking about are examples of series, which is an editorial category on Somatosphere. How did the series emerge, and could you share some of the other examples of the kind of series that you produced?
Sure, Todd, do you want to start with that?
Yeah, sure. You know, we had different kinds of series. Like, really the first one that was kind of a big project series was the transcription series, where we basically created a kind of mirror platform of the Somatosphere site in order for a sort of different set of editors to work on different problems related to HIV and HIV research. And that's still kind of ongoing. It's a little bit of a slower process, to say the least. I mean, it's, you know, there hasn't been a lot of activity on that site, but it's still there. And those editors are still, you know, very much, I guess, somehow involved. But then we've had these other series like the ethnographic case, which, just so I can say it on the podcast, which is fantastic. I think these are just absolutely thrilling. And I have to admit, when the first one, Tomas and Harris had the first sort of series, I kept thinking, I hope they ask me to contribute to this. I had to drop very, very unsubtle hints that I wanted to contribute as well. Because, I mean, these things are... for me, they're just super exciting to see, and I think they're absolutely lovely, and they do create this energy and anticipation about what's to come on the site each week, and it brings people back, and I think it does form really fantastic conversations beyond the site, and what Emily's doing is just great. And then we have these sort of occasional series as well, like the our foreign correspondence series, which has kind of gone back and forth over the years, and really was something that we started early on where we wanted to at least have some space for an appraisal of work that was being produced not in English. And, you know, we're still very much invested in that. And then we have these series that have kind of maybe just a longer bit of a life on the site. And it really depends on who's contributing and who's editing those series. But we had this nice Top of the Heap series, which was basically more or less kind of a curated series where people were talking about, you know, what are they reading and why? Some of them are just fantastic. Rabinow did one with one of his former students, Joshua Craze. The one that Warwick Anderson did, which I think was the last one that was posted, was just fantastic. And then we have some new series like the Book Forums, where we've really tried to retool things we were already doing, I think, quite well, like the book reviews, and create more of a conversation about a recent work. And the first one was Jeremy Green's book Generic. And it had some great contributors. Nancy Campbell contributed, Joe Dumit, Stefan X. It was a great form. And I think it really set the tone for kind of what was possible with these more occasional series that were going to be ongoing. So they take different forms and they have their own kind of, now they have their own kind of unique life cycle. And I think that's one of the advantages of a site like this, which is when someone gets inspired or has an idea and things start to begin to coalesce around an idea, that the site can accommodate that. And to also create a forum, you know, a forum for sort of new work that doesn't necessarily have to toe the line of work that's come before. And also a platform for that work, that's, you know, not so technically cumbersome that, you know, only one or two experts can go behind the scenes and post a contribution or edit it or, you know, refashion it. I mean, that was one of the things we really wanted, was not to move so far away from the blog format for contributors. So that, I mean, not to mention the kind of editorial labor that happens behind the scenes, but wanted to, you know, really make it user friendly for the people who are contributing. So all these things kind of come together around these series. And I think we think in terms of series in the site.
Yeah.
And we think in terms of like what kinds of continuities between different posts can we create. And then when they sort of peter out, then that's fine. And something else comes up. And it's really been the pattern. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think Todd really deserves all the credit for this book forum series, which has been, you know, I think really fantastic. And you know, not only in taking advantage of the kind of potentialities of this kind of site, but really forging a slightly different kind of a genre that does not, you know, it's appeared elsewhere, but that we're trying to develop. I hear from a lot of people that they're really, you know, enjoying them and looking forward to the next ones. And so just wanted to acknowledge the amount of work that that puts into the behind
you
the
can't
seat.
See me shaking my head. No. No. I mean, we have a book forum. Sorry. Go on.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, we have a book forum coming out today, later on today, Richard Keller's, new book, Fatal Isolation, on the heat wave in Paris in 2003. Mm-hmm. I mean, no spoilers other than it's fantastic. It's just this collection of historians and anthropologists and science studies folks reflecting on his book, not in this kind of, you know, kind of book review critical way, but really using it to, you know, make these small, in some cases, highly personal essays about the book and what it sort of signals and how it connects to different concepts of disaster and catastrophe. And I think these forums have actually been so nice in not only obviously promoting work of people who are doing, you know, really fine work and work that is getting lots of attention and deserves it. But also like being able to create something around that might actually even take that work into the domains of other projects that are that people are doing, those contributors that are, you know, providing these kinds of commentaries, and they're really inventive. And I mean, this is also, if you could probably tell from the tone of my voice, I mean, I'm also just always amazed at the quality and the the scope of these contributions. I mean, they're just stunning. I'll leave it there. It not just sounds like I'm frankly not about how good the contributions are, but that's really sort of my point.
As you're talking, I'm going back to the beginning of the conversation where Eugene, you noted and Todd as well, that it was coming as sort of a pleasant surprise that this was not going to be an ephemeral endeavor and that you were willing to commit and that it maintained a kind of life and it evolved over time. And, you know, it occurs to me that there's a few reasons I'm hearing that this may have happened. One is the astonishing way that you share responsibility and give away responsibility and opportunities for creativity to your contributors. How did that evolve? I mean, you have people who are not only sending things into you, but really generating unique kinds of formats and opportunities editorially on their own. How did you, I mean, that takes a lot of courage as an editor, first of all, but it seems to have grown organically that way.
Yes, I mean, well, let's be honest, pragmatically speaking, there's no way that one can do all this oneself.
Oh, Eugene, this isn't your full-time job.
It would
job.
Be a completely more than a full-time job, right? So part of it came out of trying to figure out how does one balance this with a scholarly career, right? And how do you? And one of the ways is to spread the responsibility and the work around. And the way to get people excited about doing this is not to give them, you know, assignments, but to give them opportunities to develop ideas that they're excited about, right? Mm-hmm. Or at least to give them certain parameters and say, here, do something, you know, interesting within this framework. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things we've been pretty good at is to develop a kind of different set of kinds of posts and kinds of niches that different people can fill within the site, so we have a lot of graduate students who have helped out in various kinds of in various capacities, in some cases working within a fairly defined set of kind of guidelines that we give them, in part because that's what they're, you know, that's what they're asking for. So and in other cases with a much more open one. And there's a possibility of kind of building, you know, moving from one to the other. And I think that's been quite, I think that's worked at least to some degree. Mm-hmm. Emily, do you have anything to add to that or thoughts about that?
Have we lost Emily?
I just heard you. I heard my name mentioned, and then I didn't hear anything else after that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm sorry. I was just wondering if you had anything to add to that, or just to generally to this question of why, you know, how we distribute our responsibility and work for the site.
Well, I was going to say that one thing that we could talk about is the interesting way that the kind of digital technology brings together such a range of audiences, not just people at different levels in their career, but also just kind of internationally. It's been really interesting for me. So I'm in an anthropology department in Amsterdam where our working language is English, but where people come from all over. So my closest colleagues are Swedish and Italian and Spanish, Peruvian, Indian, Danish, German, and of course Dutch. And it's been interesting how many, you know, I traveled to Bremen, Germany, and I met Melanie Brockerman kind of coincidentally because she's been organizing in the journal section. And, you know, I travel elsewhere, you know, kind of people, the readership is so broad. People know Somatosphere and kind of can follow along. So it does an interesting thing for kind of bringing together lots of different audiences. And just to add one other thing about this is that I was trained in an American anthropology program, and I first learned about decolonizing knowledge as an undergraduate in the U.S. But now having worked outside of the U.S. for several years, I'm really struck by how often American anthropologists speak in terms of a we that excludes all the diverse and creative work happening outside of the U.S. And so I really like Semanosphere since I have been reading it. I think since the beginning, you mentioned Ann Kelly and others that were part of your initial conversations, but they've emphasized the importance of including a broad international network of academics in the conversation. So there's obviously a lot more work that can be done, but you know, I think that as editors, you've done a nice job of reflecting how rich and interesting anthropological traditions and debates are outside of the U.S. So.
Yeah, we've worked on that pretty consciously. Todd mentioned the
foreign correspondence.
What's it called? The foreign correspondence series, and that's part of that effort, and also just an effort to include more people from places other than North America in our editorial group. I think there's a lot we can do a lot better with that, and. There's a kind of related set of issues around trying to balance, on the one hand, keeping in some ways medical anthropology at the center of things, mm-hmm. but at the same time connecting to other disciplines. And that's something I think we've also worked on quite a bit, especially connecting to history, connecting to, well, STS, I don't know, but it's been pretty much taken up and metabolized by this point in anthropology, but connecting to cultural psychiatry and some other directions as well. It was really heartening to hear your comment early on, Emily, that you found the site exciting because it was a not kind of strict disciplinary space, even at that time. So that's great to hear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this relates to another question that I was going to ask you. So I'm in a history department, and my training is in writing and history and STS. And I'm not an anthropologist by training at all. And I've been a regular reader of your site for years. And so maybe I'd like to hear you talk a little bit more about the ways that Semanosphere is and is not a project that's in medical anthropology.
Todd, do you want to try that one?
Yeah.
This is called sharing responsibility. Uh-huh. I guess.
This is also called sharing too much. I mean,
oversharing.
This is definitely oversharing. I mean, in some ways, I think probably the thing that I'm just going to sort of speak in my sort of more personal relationship to the site and the effort there from the beginning is, I think the thing that's kept me involved in the site is that the site has allowed for my own kind of promiscuous relationship with anthropology to come through as I move through the history of medicine, the history of science, and through philosophy. In sort of big, air quotes, and in different aspects of anthropology. I mean, I feel like that's, the site has kind of allowed for, I guess, for me to sort of feel my way through my own work in relation to the site. So like a lot of the people who, we sort of talk about contributions with somehow reflect these, for at least for me, these sort of different people that I want to be talking with and engaged with anyways. Mm-hmm. So, as a kind of personal connection to that, I guess, disciplinary soundness of anthropology or medical anthropology in the site. I've never really felt that, in fact, actually, it's always been the inverse of that. It's always been the kind of turning that inside out in terms of who should be in a conversation. And I think especially with some of these really nice projects like the Ethnographic Case and like the Commonplaces, that there is almost this, it's not overdetermined, but there's this attention to include people who are working in these different modes. Like, for instance, I've never known exactly how to call Emily Martin's work. I think of it very much as anthropology, but at the same time, I find it as a huge resource as somebody working in the history of medicine and science. I think there are a lot of people who fit this profile of not fitting a profile who contribute to the site. And I think that's helped to, that's helped to keep the site kind of porous in a way, That's my effort to answer my question.
Yeah, no, I'll add, just personally, in the period of time that I've been working on the site, I've been in situated in interdisciplinary settings. So I did a postdoc in transcultural psychiatry at McGill and was also involved in the social studies of medicine department over there. And now I'm in comparative human development here at Chicago. So to me, you know, it's been kind of it's made a lot of sense to think about this in terms of how to kind of connect disciplinary orientations and methods to other shared concerns. And I don't know that I have a clear kind of answer, but it feels like the site is a nice, is a useful place for thinking through those kinds of questions, right? We have one of our series, that's one of the kind of ongoing ones, is about this question of collaboration and interdisciplinarity. Particularly focusing on some of the questions surrounding the relationship between the social sciences, biosciences, and this issue of kind of a post-representational anthropology, as you put it, Emily. The point in some ways is that, you know, when we come upon these issues in our own thinking, we have often, I mean, I've kind of turned to the site and said, well, let's make a series about this. Uh-huh. And this is a way to think this through, right? Yeah. This is a way to think it through with other colleagues.
So it's become integrated in your own scholarly life, in the way that you approach or think about ideas?
If you're asking me, yes.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Uh-huh. That's fascinating.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think it's always a struggle. I think there's always a kind of a struggle to maintain a balance in terms of time and these kinds of just more pragmatic issues. But in terms of how to orient oneself generally in the discipline, in the field, in terms of kind of questions one's asking, you know, for me, it's been central to that. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Emily, do you?
Yeah, I was thinking about it.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was thinking about it not just being part of my professional life, but like a little bit part of my personal life. I don't, you know, I haven't had a smartphone for that long. But I have a smartphone, and I've had it actually since my first child was born. He's now three, and I have two small children. They're terrible sleepers, and so I spend a lot of time lying next to them, waiting for them to fall asleep because it comforts them. And so, you know, I'm a big fan of the book. I love the book. I just have a book out. I think a book is great, but I don't have that much. You know, often I have 20 minutes in. Just kind of my phone on me. So it's actually like quite lovely to be able to keep up to date intellectually. Like the pieces are short. I can there's a couple or, one a day and I can kind of just read them and think, okay, this is something to stay engaged with, in those kind of wee hours when my children aren't sleeping. So.
It's lovely. I'd like to move ahead and talk a little bit about where you see the future of Somatosphere going. I hope that it continues to stay alive and that you maintain the energy to keep it going. But how do you see it continuing to evolve, and where would you like to see it go? Eugene, could you start us?
Sure. I mean, one of the things that in thinking about this, I've been thinking for a while about how to make the site into something that I would, and others of us who have been involved in quite closely be able to disengage or go do, other things without the whole thing disappearing. Mm-hmm. One step in that direction was putting together this editorial collaborative, mm-hmm. which we did about a year and a half ago. So the idea is that that's a larger group of people that were involved in the site before. And the notion there for it not to function a little bit differently than the usual editorial advisory board of a journal. The notion here is really that it's a set of resources that the people who are involved are meant to be much more actively involved in developing their own series, in developing their own, developing really the ideas for the direction of the site all around. The other thing we've done this about for about half a year, we've had a managing editor as well, who's Deanna Day, who's doing an excellent job running the kind of day-to-day aspects of the site, posting and doing a lot of copy editing and managing particular, a lot of stuff behind the scenes. So part of it has been a matter of kind of figuring out just how to keep this infrastructure of the site alive and going, so that we can think about these questions. And that's sort of something we're in the process of getting set up. Uh-huh. Somebody else want to jump in terms of other?
I mean everything that Eugene said, yeah. And this is precisely it. I'm not that concerned that the site's going to somehow outlive its usefulness. In fact, I sort of trust that it'll recognize its own finitude. You know, I mean, it's time to, you know, close it down. It's time to close it down. But I think, yeah, exactly. At this point, I mean, I think that idea of the distribution of responsibility and thinking of someone else kind of taking charge of developing some of these projects that the site is clearly, you know, good at supporting, is really ideal. You know, and as long as it continues to be useful, and I mean, I think that's just really the key. As long as it continues to be a resource for people, then I think, you know, then it's worth the kind of hidden labor that goes into making these contributions available. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the kind of, you know, this kind of network of communication that happens behind the scenes to make something possible, I think is, you know, there is a lot of work there, but as long as it, you know, as long as it's resulting in something that, you know, we all feel we can all sort of agree that is worthwhile. I think that, you know, it has a kind of nice future, but I don't know what that future is exactly.
There's, you know, there's a couple of other things I would just add to this, things that we've discussed a number of times and that, you know, we may be trying to develop. You know, one is that I've wanted for a while to potentially, you know, explore more possibilities of non-textual kinds of forms of representation. And I think these last two series, the Commonplaces and the Ethnographic Field Notes, have done a great job of integrating images. You know, it's possible that at some point we could do more with audio. You know, this New Books Network has done an amazing job of using that medium so wonderfully, and I think that there's so much that can be done around audio, kind of linked up with an ethnographic sensibility. Mm-hmm. That would be interesting to explore. But again, that's a whole, you know, it's a huge investment of time and energy that would take. The other thing that I think we need to think about is, and again, this is a kind of an infrastructural question that has probably been worked out better by, you know, some of the new online, online only sites, journals, but the question of how, to make the post into something that has a sort of a life beyond its, you know, beyond the time that it appears on your, in your, you know, screen as the last, the news feed, right, as it were. So the question of whether we can have something like, we've investigated the possibility of getting DOI numbers or something of that sort to identify posts, and that's been a little difficult, but I think that somewhere we need to move in the direction of kind of legitimate animating those things a little bit more, so they have, so that they they are able to have a life a little bit beyond this 72-hour shelf life of blog posts or yes. whatever it is.
This question of legitimation also pertains to the problem of making this count for all of the people who work in academia, which seems like it's the majority yes. of your contributors. How have you, you certainly don't seem to be lacking for substantial contributors, both at the early career stage and the, you know, people who are more senior in your career, their careers. Have you seen any changes in this over time? And I'm wondering, even on your own vitas, does this stuff count in your university lives, either your contributions or your editorial work?
Yeah, that's a, you know, that's a tough question. And in part, I mean, I think it's a question of how to translate the site to those who within, you know, a university context are doing the assessing. I mean, I just, mm-hmm. I've just gone through the tenure process and, you know, I don't know how it factored into the decisions on the part of, you know, the college and the university. But it's certainly, I mean, for me, it's always been, it's been a very kind of transparent way of contributing to the field, and whether or not it's the product is something like, you know, a published paper or a published review, and whether or not it gets counted the same as a journal has never really been that much of an issue. It's really, it's really just been the kind of scholarly activity that's being recognized. But I think that that is changing along the lines that Eugene kind of outlined, mm-hmm. that there is sort of a desire to make sure that, you know, there's a recognition of the significance and reach of these pieces. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not, I mean, we spend a lot of time tracking numbers of hits for pieces and downloads and things just to, you know, just so we're aware of kind of what's getting traction and what's not. And I think the job in the future is really going to be finding ways to translate that for people who may or may not be as, I guess, sympathetic to this kind of effort. Mm-hmm. But
I mean, and also recognizing the fact that we, sorry.
No, keep, go.
Just recognizing the fact that we live in very, you know, even among those of us having this conversation, live in different kinds of worlds in terms of the kind of metrics by which our scholarship is measured, right? I mean, especially I think in Europe, Emily, you can speak mm-hmm. to this. This is a very different kind of system has been put into place over the last 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, certainly. I was also going to say, though, just even outside, I think keeping the labor relations issues and who's contributing and who's ignored is really important. Mm-hmm. But it's also really, I mean, I think it's great to be able to, you know, I've asked PhDs and postdocs to contribute, and people are excited to see their work it gets an audience. And that's, you know, there's something really valuable in that too. And I was going to say, there's also something really valuable in kind of as people discuss anthropology needing to become more public, you know, needing to sort of, you know, I think because there's, you know, no piece gets through, at least to my knowledge, without a few stage, you know, I can speak for the ethnographic case, we do a lot of editing, and then there's, you know, copy editing on top of that, and, you know, kind of no piece gets onto the site without a lot of people looking over it. And if you're a graduate student, you know, writing or contributing, there's something really nice about being able to have a public voice in a well-read site that somebody else has kind of protected you a little bit by editing, you know, editing what you're doing. And, you know, it's a kind of training for how to kind of create a ability to write for a public broader audience as well, which I think is really, you know, I think people want that. And it's quite valuable to learn how to write, you know, a kind of piece that you have to consider also your reader and kind of your storytelling ability and your audience.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
Well, do you want to, is there anything else that you'd like to add that I haven't asked you about?
Eugene?
Well, I guess I would just make a, I guess I'd like to use this as an opportunity to speak to folks who are listening to this right now and to say that to kind of offer an invitation to anyone to get in touch with us if you're interested in contributing a piece for the site, if you're interested in getting more involved in somehow in other aspects of work on the site, we have a lot of people who are doing different kinds of things to do with the site, and there's a lot of ways to get to get involved and do different kinds of interesting work and really contribute. So that's just, please get in touch with us.
How would they best do that?
Yes. So one way is to contact Deanna Day, our managing editor.
And she's on the masthead on the site?
She's on the masthead, right. So you should be able to pull up her information there. The other way is just to write to our contact email, which is admin@somatosphere.net. And that's something one of us checks all the time.
Okay, fantastic. Well, thank you so much for talking with me. I really have enjoyed it. And I love your site and I read it regularly. Thanks for all your creative efforts going forward. I look forward to seeing how this evolves. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.